isolated words like seagull and traffic and tumult and dawn carried something of its airborne distances, its sweeps from high to low. And just as I was nodding off, I fell into sort of an overpowering sense memory of the narrow, windy, exhaust-smelling park near our old apartment by the East River, roar of traffic washing abstractly above as the river swirled with fast, confusing currents and sometimes appeared to flow in two different directions. 11. I didn't sleep much that night and was so exhausted by the time I got to school and stowed the painting in my locker that I didn't even notice that Kotku, hanging all over Boris like nothing had happened, was sporting a fat lip. Only when I heard this tough senior guy, Eddie Rizzo, say, "Mack truck," did I see that somebody had smacked her pretty good in the face. She was going around laughing a bit nervously and telling people that she got hit in the mouth by a car door, but in a sort of embarrassed way that, to me at least, didn't ring true. "Did you do that?" I said to Boris, when next I saw him alone, or relatively alone, in English class. Boris shrugged.
"I didn't want to."
"What do you mean, you didn't want to?" Boris looked shocked.
"She made me."
"She made you," I repeated.
"Look, just because you're jealous of her."
"Fuck you," I said. "I don't give a shit about you and Kotku. I have things of my own to worry about. You can beat her head in for all I care."
"Oh God, Potter," said Boris, suddenly sobered. "Did he come back? That guy?"
"No," I said after a brief pause. "Not yet."
"Well, I mean, fuck it,"
I said, when Boris kept on staring at me. "It's his problem, not mine. He'll just have to figure something out."
"How much is he in for?"
"No clue."
"Can't you get the money for him?"
"Me?" Boris looked away. I poked him in the arm. "No, what do you mean, Boris? Can't I get it for him? What are you talking about?" I said when he didn't answer.
"Never mind,"
he said quickly, settling back in his chair. And I didn't have a chance to pursue the conversation, because then Spearsitskaya walked into the room, all primed to talk about boring Silas Marner. And that was it. 12. That night, my dad came home early with bags of carryout from his favorite Chinese, including an extra order of the spicy dumplings I liked, and he was in such a good mood that it was as if I'd dreamed Mr. Silver and the stuff from the night before.
"So,"
I said, and stopped. Zandra, having finished her spring rolls, was rinsing glasses at the sink, but there was only so much I felt comfortable saying in front of her. He smiled his big dad smile at me, a smile that sometimes made stewardesses bump him up to first class.
"So what?"
he said, pushing aside his carton of Szechuan shrimp to reach for a fortune cookie. Zandra had the water up loud. "Did you get everything straightened out?"
"What?"
he said lightly.
"You mean with Bobo Silver?"
"Bobo?
Listen, I hope you weren't worried about that."
"You weren't, were you?"
"Well, Bobo," he laughed. "They call him the Mensch. He's actually a nice guy. Well, you talk to him yourself. We just had some crossed wires, is all."
"What does 5 points mean?"
"Look, it was just a mix-up.
I mean," he said, "these people are characters. They have their own language, their own ways of doing things. But hey," he laughed, "this is great. When I met with him over at Caesar's, that's what Bobo calls his office, you know, the pool at Caesar's. Anyway, when I met with him, you know what he kept saying? That's a good kid you got there, Larry. Real little gentleman. I mean, I don't know what you said to him, but I do actually owe you one."
"Huh," I said in a neutral voice, helping myself to more rice. But inwardly, I was almost drunk at the lift in his mood, the same flood of elation I'd felt as a small child when the silences broke, when his footsteps grew light again, and you heard him laughing at something, humming at the shaving mirror. My dad cracked open his fortune cookie and laughed.
"See here," he said, balling it up and tossing it over to me.
I wonder who sits around in Chinatown and thinks up these things.
Aloud, I read it. You have an unusual equipment for fate. Exercise with care.
Unusual equipment, said Zandra, coming up behind to put her arms around his neck. That sounds kind of dirty.
Ah, my dad turned to kiss her. A dirty mind, the fountain of youth.
Apparently.
13.
I gave you a fat lip that time, said Boris,
who clearly felt guilty about the Kotku business, since he'd brought it up out of nowhere in our companionable morning silence on the school bus.
Yeah, and I knocked your head against the fucking wall.
I didn't mean to.
Didn't mean what?
To hit you in the mouth.
You meant it with her?
In a way, yeah,
he said evasively.
In a way.
Boris made an exasperated sound.
I told her I was sorry. Everything is fine with us now, no problem. And besides, what business is it of yours?
You brought it up, not me.
He looked at me for an odd, off-centered moment, then laughed.
Can I tell you something?
What?
He put his head close to mine.
Kotku and me tripped last night,
he said quietly.
Dropped acid together. It was great.
Really? Where did you get it?
E was easy enough to find at our school. Boris and I had taken it at least a dozen times. Magical, speechless nights where we had walked into the desert half delirious at the stars. But nobody ever had acid. Boris rubbed his nose.
Well, her mom knows this scary old guy named Jimmy that works at a gun shop. He hooked us up with 5 hits. I don't know why I bought 5. I wish I'd bought 6. Anyway, I still have some. God, it was fantastic.
Oh, yeah?
Now that I looked at him more closely, I realized that his pupils were dilated and strange.
Are you still on it?
Maybe a little. I only slept like 2 hours. Anyway, we totally made up. It was like, even the flowers on her mom's bedspread were friendly. And we were made out of the same stuff as the flowers. And we realized how much we loved each other and needed each other no matter what. And how everything hateful that had happened between us was only out of love.
Wow, I said, in a voice that I guess must have sounded sadder than I'd intended, from the way that Boris brought his eyebrows together and looked at me.
Well,
I said, when he kept staring at me.
What is it?
He blinked and shook his head.
No, I can just see it. This mist of sadness, sort of, around your head. It's like you're a soldier or something, a person from history, walking on a battlefield, maybe, with all these deep feelings.
Boris, you're still completely fried.
Not really, he said dreamily. I sort of snap in and out of it, but I still see colored sparks coming off things if I look from the corner of my eye just right.
14. A week or so passed without incident, either with my dad or on the Boris Kotku front, enough time that I felt safe bringing the pillowcase home. I had noticed, when taking it out of my locker, how unusually bulky and heavy it seemed. And when I got it upstairs and out of the pillowcase, I saw why. Clearly, I'd been blasted out of my mind when I wrapped and taped it. All those layers of newspaper, wound with a whole extra-large roll of heavy-duty, fiber-reinforced packing tape, had seemed like a prudent caution when I was freaked out and high. But back in my room, in the sober light of afternoon, it looked like it had been bound and wrapped by an insane and/or homeless person. Mummified, practically. So much tape on it that it wasn't even quite square anymore. Even the corners were round. I got the sharpest kitchen knife I could find and sawed at a corner, cautiously at first, worried that the knife would slip in and damage the painting. And then, more energetically. But I'd only gotten partway through a 3-inch section, and my hands were starting to get tired, when I heard Zandra coming in downstairs. And I put it back in the pillowcase and taped it to the back of my headboard again until I knew they were going to be gone for a while. Boris had promised me that we would do two of the leftover hits of acid as soon as his mind got back to usual, which is how he put it. He still felt a bit spaced out, he confided, saw moving patterns in the fake wood grain of his desk at school, and the first few times he'd smoked weed, he'd started out-and-out tripping again. That sounds kind of intense, I said.
No, it's cool. I can make it stop when I want to. I think we should take it at the playground, he added. On Thanksgiving holiday, maybe.
The abandoned playground was where we'd gone to take E every time but the first, when Zandra came beating on my bedroom door asking us to help her fix the washing machine, which of course we weren't able to do, but 45 minutes of standing around with her in the laundry room during the best part of the roll had been a tremendous bring-down.
Is it going to be a lot stronger than E?
No. Well, yes, but it's wonderful, trust me. I kept wanting Kotku and me to be outside in the air, except was too much that close to the highway, lights, cars. Maybe this weekend?
So that was something to look forward to. But just as I was starting to feel good and even hopeful about things again, ESPN hadn't been on for a week, which was definitely some kind of record. I found my father waiting for me when I got home from school.
I need to talk to you, Theo, he said the moment I walked in. Do you have a minute?
I paused.
Well, okay, sure.
The living room looked almost as if it had been burgled. Papers scattered everywhere, even the cushions on the sofa slightly out of place. He stopped pacing. He was moving a bit stiffly, as if his knee hurt him.
Come over here,
he said in a friendly voice.
Sit down.
I sat. My dad exhaled. He ran a hand through his hair.
The lawyer,
he said, leaning forward with his clasped hands between his knees and meeting my eye frankly. I waited.
Your mom's lawyer, I mean. I know this is short notice, but
I really need you to get on the phone with him for me. It was windy. Outside, blown sand rattled against the glass doors, and the patio awning flapped with a sound like a flag snapping.
What?
I said, after a cautious pause.
She'd spoken of seeing a lawyer after he left, about a divorce, I figured. But what had come of it, I didn't know.
Well, my dad took a deep breath. He looked at the ceiling. Here's the thing. I guess you've noticed I haven't been betting my sports anymore, right?
Well, he said, I want to quit. Well, I'm ahead, so to speak.
It's not... He paused and seemed to think.
I mean, quite honestly, I've gotten pretty good at this stuff by doing my homework and being disciplined about it. I crunch my numbers. I don't bet impulsively. And I mean, like I say, I've been doing pretty good. I've socked away a lot of money these past months. It's just...
Right, I said uncertainly in the silence that followed, wondering what he was getting at.
I mean, why tempt fate?
Because, hand on heart, I am an alcoholic. I'm the first to admit that. I can't drink at all. One drink is too many, and 1,000's not enough. Giving up booze was the best thing I ever did. And I mean, with gambling, even with my addictive tendencies and all, it's always been kind of different. Sure, I've had some scrapes, but I've never been like some of these guys that, I don't know, that get so far in that they embezzle money and wreck the family business or whatever. But, he laughed, if you don't want a haircut, sooner or later, better stop hanging out at the barbershop, right?
So,
I said cautiously, after waiting for him to continue.
So, phew.
My dad ran both hands through his hair. He looked boyish, dazed, incredulous. Here's the thing. I'm really wanting to make some big changes right now, because I have the opportunity to get in on the ground floor of this great business. Buddy of mine has a restaurant, and I mean, I think it's going to be a really great thing for all of us. Once-in-a-lifetime thing, actually, you know? Xandra's having such a hard time at work right now with her boss being such a shit, and I don't know, I just think this is going to be a lot more sane.
My dad? A restaurant? Wow.
That's great, I said.
Wow.
Yeah, my dad nodded.
It's really great. The thing is, though, to open a place like this,
what kind of restaurant?
My dad yawned, wiped red eyes.
Oh, just simple American food. Steaks and hamburgers and stuff. Just really simple and well-prepared.
The thing is, though, for my buddy to get the place open and pay his restaurant taxes...
Restaurant taxes?
Oh, God, yes. You wouldn't believe the kind of fees they've got out here. You've got to pay your restaurant taxes, your liquor license taxes, liability insurance. It's a huge cash outlay to get a place like this up and running.
Well, I could see where he was going with this. If you need the money in my savings account...
My dad looked startled.
What? You know, that account you started for me. If you need the money, that's fine.
Oh, yeah.
My dad was silent for a moment. Thanks. I really appreciate that, pal.
But actually... He had stood up and was walking around. The thing is, I actually see a really smart way we can do this. Just a short-term solution in order to get the place up and running, you know. We'll make it back in a few weeks. I mean, a place like this, the location and all, it's like having a license to print money. It's just the initial expense. This town is crazy with the taxes and the fees and so forth. I mean, he laughed, half apologetically. You know, I wouldn't ask you if it wasn't an emergency.
Sorry, I said, after a confused pause. I mean, like I was saying, I really need you to make this call for me. Here's the number.
He had it all written out for me on a sheet of paper. A 212 number, I noticed. You need to telephone this guy and speak to him yourself. His name is Bracegirdle. I looked at the paper and then at my dad.
I don't understand.
You don't have to understand. All you have to do is say what I tell you.
What does it have to do with me?
Look, just do it. Tell him who you are, need to have a word, business matter, blah, blah, blah.
But
who was this person? What do you want me to say? My father took a long breath. He was taking care to control his expression, something he was fairly good at.
He's a lawyer, he said on an out-breath.
Your mother's lawyer. He needs to make arrangements to wire this amount of money. My eyes popped at the sum he was pointing to, $65,000, into this account, dragging his finger to the string of numbers beneath it. Tell him I've decided to send you to a private school. He'll need your name and social security number. That's it.
Private school?
I said, after a disoriented pause.
Well, you see, it's for tax reasons.
I don't want to go to private school.
Wait, wait, just hear me out.
As long as these funds are used for your benefit in the official sense, we've got no problem. And the restaurant is for all our benefit, see? Maybe, in the end, yours most of all. And I mean, I could make the call myself. It's just that if we angle this the right way, we'd be saving like $30,000 that would go to the government otherwise. Hell, I will send you to a private school if you want. Boarding school? I could send you to Andover with all that extra money.
I just don't want half of it to end up with the IRS, know what I'm saying?
Also, I mean, the way this thing is set up, by the time you end up going to college, it's going to end up costing you money. Because with that amount of money in there, it means you won't be eligible for a scholarship. The college financial aid people are going to look right at that account and put you in a different income bracket and take 75% of it the first year. Poof. This way, at least, you'll get the full use of it, you see? Right now, when it could actually do some good.
But,
falsetto voice, lolled tongue, goofy stare.
Oh, come on, Theo,
he said in his normal voice when I kept on staring at him. Swear to God, I don't have time for this. I need you to make this call ASAP, before the offices close back east. If you need to sign something, tell him to FedEx the papers or fax them. We just need to get this done as soon as possible, okay?
But why do I need to do it?
My dad sighed. He rolled his eyes. Look, don't give me that, Theo, he said. I know you know the score because I've seen you check in the mail.
Yes,
he said over my objections. Yes, you do. Every day you're out at that mailbox like a fucking shot.
I was so baffled by this that I didn't even know how to reply.
But
I glanced down at the paper, and the figure leaped out again. $65,000. Without warning, my dad snapped out and whacked me across the face, so hard and fast that for a second I didn't know what had happened. Then almost before I could blink, he hit me again with his fist, cartoon wham, bright crack like a camera flash. As I wobbled, my knees had gone loose, everything white. He caught me by the throat with a sharp upward thrust and forced me up on tiptoe, so I was gasping for breath.
Look here!
He was shouting in my face, his nose 2 inches from mine. But Popper was jumping and barking like crazy, and the ringing in my ears had climbed to such a pitch it was like he was screaming at me through radio fuzz.
You're going to call this guy, rattling the paper in my face, and say what I fucking tell you. Don't make this any harder than it has to be, because I will make you do this, Theo. No lie! I will break your arm. I will beat the ever-loving shit out of you if you don't get on the phone right now. Okay? Okay?
He repeated in the dizzy, ear-buzzing silence. His cigarette breath was sour in my face. He let go my throat. He stepped back.
Do you hear me? Say something.
I swiped an arm over my face. Tears were streaming down my cheeks, but they were automatic, like tap water. No emotion attached to them. My dad squeezed his eyes shut. He shook his head.
Look, he said in a crisp voice, still breathing hard. I'm sorry.
He didn't sound sorry, I noted, in a clear, hard remove of my mind. He sounded like he still wanted to beat the shit out of me. But I swear, Theo, just trust me on this. You have to do this for me. Everything was blurred, and I reached up with both hands to straighten my glasses. My breaths were so loud that they were the noisiest things in the room. My dad, hand on hips, turned his eyes to the ceiling.
Oh, come on, he said. Just stop it.
I said nothing. We stood there for another long moment or two. Popper had stopped barking and was looking between us apprehensively like he was trying to figure out what was going on.
It's just, well, you know,
now he was all reasonable again.
I'm sorry, Theo. I swear I am. But I'm really in a bind here. We need this money right now, this minute. We really do.
He was trying to meet my eyes. His gaze was frank, sensible.
Who is this guy?
I said, looking not at him but at the wall behind his head, my voice for whatever reason coming out scorched sounding and strange. Your mother's lawyer, how many times do I have to tell you? He was massaging his knuckles like he'd hurt his hand hitting me.
See, the thing is, Theo,
another sigh.
I mean, I'm sorry, but I swear I wouldn't be so upset if this wasn't so important. Because I am really, really behind the eight ball here. This is just a temporary thing, you understand? Just until the business gets off the ground. Because the whole thing could collapse just like that, snapped fingers. Unless I start getting some of these creditors paid off. And the rest of it, I will use to send you to a better school. Private school, maybe? You'd like that, wouldn't you?
Already, carried away by his own rap, he was dialing the number. He handed me the telephone and, before anyone answered, dashed over and picked up the extension across the room.
Hello,
I said to the woman who answered the phone.
Excuse me.
My voice scratchy and uneven. I still couldn't quite believe what was happening.
May I speak to Mr.
My dad stabbed his finger at the paper. Bracegirdle.
Mr. Bracegirdle,
I said aloud.
And who may I say is calling?
Both my voice and hers were way too loud due to the fact that my dad was listening on the extension.
Theodore Decker?
Oh, yes,
said the man's voice when he came on the other end.
Hello, Theodore, How are you?
Fine. You sound like you have a cold. Tell me, do you have a bit of a cold?
Yes, I said uncertainly. My dad, across the room, was mouthing the word laryngitis.
That's a shame,
said the echoing voice, so loud that I had to hold the phone slightly away from my ear.
I never think of people catching colds in the sunshine, where you are. At any rate, I'm glad you phoned me. I didn't have a good way to get in touch with you directly. I know things are probably still very hard, but I hope things are better than they were the last time I saw you.
I was silent. I'd met this person?
It was a bad time,
said Mr. Bracegirdle, correctly interpreting my silence. The velvety, fluent voice struck a chord.
Okay. Wow,
I said.
Snowstorm, remember?
Right. He'd appeared maybe a week after my mother had died. Oldish man with a full head of white hair, snappily dressed, striped shirt, bow tie. He and Mrs. Barber had seemed to know each other, or at any rate, he had seemed to know her. He'd sat across from me in the armchair nearest the sofa and talked a lot, confusing stuff, although all that really stuck in my mind was the story he told of how he met my mother. Massive snowstorm, no taxis in sight, when, preceded by a fan of wet snow, an occupied cab had plowed to the corner of 84th and Park. Window rolled down. My mother,
a vision of loveliness,
going as far as East 57th. Was he headed that way?
She always talked about that storm,
I said. My father, phone to his ear, glanced at me sharply.
When the city was shut down that time.
He laughed.
What a lovely young lady. I'd come out of a late meeting. Elderly trustee up on Park and 92nd. Shipping heiress, now dead, alas. Anyway, down I came from the penthouse to the street, lugging my litigation bag, of course, and a foot had fallen. Perfect silence. Kids were pulling sleds down Park Avenue. Anyway, the trains weren't running above 72nd, and there I was, knee-deep and trudging, when, whoops, here came a yellow cab with your mother in it, crunching to a stop, as if she'd been sent by a search party. Hop in, I'll give you a ride. Midtown, absolutely deserted. Snowflakes whirling down and every light in the city on. And there we were, rolling along at about 2 miles per hour. We might as well have been in a sleigh, sailing right through the red lights. No point stopping. I remember we talked about Fairfield Porter. There'd just been a show in New York. And then on to Frank O'Hara and Lana Turner. And what year they'd finally closed the old Horn and Hardart, the Automat. And then we discovered that we worked across the street from each other. It was the beginning of a beautiful friendship, as they say.
I glanced over at my dad. He had a funny look on his face, lips pressed tight as if he was about to be sick on the carpet.
We talked a bit about your mother's estate, if you remember, said the voice on the other end of the phone. Not much. It wasn't the time, but I had hoped you would come to see me when you were ready to talk. I would have telephoned you before you left town if I'd known you were going.
I looked at my dad. I looked at the paper in my hand.
I want to go to private school,
I blurted.
Really? Said Mr. Bracegirdle. I think that may be an excellent idea. Where were you thinking about going? Back east? Or somewhere out there?
We hadn't thought this out. I looked at my dad.
I said,
while my father grimaced at me and waved his hand frantically.
There may be good boarding schools out west, though I don't know about them,
Mr. Bracegirdle was saying.
I went to Milton, which was a wonderful experience for me, and my oldest son went there too, for a year anyway, though it wasn't at all the right place for him.
As he talked on, from Milton to Kent to various boarding schools attended by children of friends and acquaintances, my dad had scribbled a note. He threw it at me. Wire me the money, it said. Down payment.
I said, not knowing how else to introduce the subject.
Did my mother leave me some money?
Well, not exactly, said Mr. Bracegirdle, seeming to cool slightly at the question, or maybe it was just the awkwardness of the interruption. She was having some financial troubles toward the end, as I'm sure you're well aware. But you do have a 529, and she also set up a little UTMA for you right before she died.
What is that?
My dad, his eyes on me, was listening very closely.
Uniform transfer to minors. It's to be used for your education. But it can't be used for anything else. Not while you're still a minor, anyway.
Why can't it? I said after a brief pause, as he seemed to stress the final point so much. Because it's the law, he said curtly.
But certainly something can be worked out if you want to go away to school. I know of a client who used part of her eldest son's 529 for a fancy kindergarten for her youngest. Not that I think $20,000 a year is a prudent expenditure at that level. The most expensive crayons in Manhattan, surely. But yes, so you understand, that's how it works.
I looked at my dad. So there's no way you could, say, wire me $65,000, I said, if I needed it right this minute?
No, absolutely not. So just put that out of your mind.
His manner had changed. Clearly he'd revised his opinion of me, no longer my mother's son and a good kid, but a grasping little creep.
By the way, may I ask how you happened to arrive at that particular figure?
I glanced at my dad, who had a hand over his eyes.
Shit, I thought, and then realized I'd said it out loud.
Well, no matter, said Mr. Bracegirdle silkily.
It's simply not possible. No way? No way, no how.
Okay, fine. I tried hard to think, but my mind was running in two directions at once.
Could you send me part of it, then? Like, half?
No. It would all have to be arranged directly with the college or school of your choice. In other words, I'm going to need to see bills and pay bills. There's a lot of paperwork as well, and in the unlikely event you decide not to attend college. As he talked on, confusingly, about various ins and outs of the funds my mother had set up for me, all of which were fairly restrictive, as far as either my father or me getting our hands immediately on actual spendable cash. My dad, holding the phone out from his ear, had something very like an expression of horror on his face.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you, sir,
I said, trying hard to wrap up the conversation.
There are tax advantages, of course, setting it up like this. But what she really wanted was to make sure your father would never be able to touch it.
Oh? I said, uncertainly, in the overly long silence that followed. Something in his tone had made me suspect that he knew my father might be the Lord Vaderish presence breathing audibly, audibly to me, whether audibly to him I don't know, over the other line.
There are other considerations as well. I mean,
decorous silence.
I don't know if I ought to tell you this, but an unauthorized party has twice tried to make a large withdrawal on the account.
What? I said, after a sick pause.
You see, said Mr. Bracegirdle, his voice as distant as if it were coming from the bottom of the sea, I'm the custodian on the account. And about 2 months after your mother died, someone walked in the bank in Manhattan during business hours and tried to forge my signature on the papers. Well, they know me at the main branch, and they called me right away. But while they were still on the phone with me, the man slipped out the door before the security guard was able to approach and ask for ID. That was, my goodness, 2 years ago. But then, only last week, did you get the letter I wrote you about this?
No, I said, when at last I realized I needed to say something.
Well, without going into it too much, there was a peculiar phone call.
from someone purporting to be your attorney out there, requesting a transfer of funds. And then, checking into it, we found out that some party with access to your social security number had applied for and received a rather large line of credit in your name. Do you happen to know anything about that? Well, not to worry, he continued, when I didn't say anything. I have a copy of your birth certificate here, and I faxed it to the issuing bank and had the line shut down immediately. And I've alerted Equifax and all the credit agencies. Even though you're a minor and legally unable to enter into such a contract, you could be responsible for any such debts incurred in your name once you come of age. At any rate, I urge you to be very careful with your social security number in the future. It's possible to have a new social issued, in theory, although the red tape is such a headache that I don't suggest it. I was in a cold sweat when I hung up the telephone, and completely unprepared for the howl that my father let out. I thought he was angry at me. But when he just stood there with the phone still in his hand, I looked at him a little closer and realized he was crying. It was horrible. I had no idea what to do. He sounded like he'd had boiling water poured over him, like he was turning into a werewolf, like he was being tortured. I left him there, and Popchick hurrying up the stairs ahead of me. Clearly he didn't want any part of this howling either. Went in my room and locked the door and sat on the side of my bed with my head in my hands, wanting aspirin, but not wanting to go down to the bathroom to get it. Wishing Xandra would hurry up and come home. The screams from downstairs were ungodly, like he was being burned with a blowtorch. I got my iPod, tried to find some loudish music that wasn't upsetting. Shostakovich's Fourth, which though classical, actually was a bit upsetting. And lay on my bed with the earbuds in and stared at the ceiling, while Popper stood with his ears up, and stared at the closed door, the hairs on his neck erect and bristling. 15.
He told me you had a fortune, said Boris, later that night at the playground, while we were sitting around waiting for the drugs to work.
I slightly wished we had picked another night to take them, but Boris had insisted it would make me feel better.
You believed I had a fortune and wouldn't tell you?
We'd been sitting on the swings for what seemed like forever, waiting for just what, I didn't know. Boris shrugged.
I don't know. There are a lot of things you don't tell me. I would have told you. It's all right, though.
I don't know what to do. Though it was very subtle, I'd begun to notice glittering gray kaleidoscope patterns turning sluggishly in the gravel by my foot. Dirty ice, diamonds, sparkles of broken glass. Things are getting scary. Boris nudged me.
There's something I didn't tell you either, Potter.
What?
My dad has to leave. For his job. He's going back to Australia in a few months. Then on, I think, to Russia.
There was a silence that maybe lasted 5 seconds, but felt like it lasted an hour.
Boris? Gone?
Everything seemed frozen, like the planet had stopped.
Well, I'm not going, said Boris serenely.
His face in the moonlight had taken on an unnerving, electrified flicker, like a black-and-white film from the silent era.
Fuck that. I'm running away.
Where?
Dunno. Do you want to come?
Yes, I said without thinking, and then,
is Kotku going?
He grimaced.
I don't know.
The filmic quality had become so stage-lit and stark that all semblance of real life had vanished. We'd been neutralized, fictionalized, flattened. My field of vision was bordered by a black rectangle. I could see the subtitles running at the bottom of what he was saying. Then, at almost exactly the same time, the bottom dropped out of my stomach.
Oh, God,
I thought, running both hands through my hair and feeling way too overwhelmed to explain what I was feeling. Boris was still talking.
and I realized if I didn't want to be lost forever in this grainy Nosferatu world, sharp shadows and achromatism, it was important to listen to him and not get so hung up on the artificial texture of things.
I mean, I guess I understand,
he was saying mournfully, as speckles and raindrops of decay danced all around him.
With her, it's not even running away. She's of age, you know. But she lived on the street once and didn't like it.
Kotku lived on the street? I felt an unexpected surge of compassion for her, orchestrated somehow, with a cinematic music swell almost, although the sadness itself was perfectly real.
Well, I have too, in Ukraine. But I would be with my friends Max and Seriosa, never more than few days at a time. Sometimes it was good fun. We'd kip in basement of abandoned buildings, drink, take butorphanol, build campfires even. But I always went home when my dad sobered up. With Kotku, though, it was different. This one boyfriend of her mother's, he was doing stuff to her. So she left. Slept in doorways, begged for change, blew guys for money. Was out of school for a while. She was brave to come back, to try and finish after what happened. Because, I mean, people say stuff, you know.
We were silent, contemplating the awfulness of this. Me feeling as if I had experienced in these few words the entire weight and sweep of Kotku's life, and Boris's.
I'm sorry I don't like Kotku, I said, really meaning it.
Well, I'm sorry too, said Boris reasonably. His voice seemed to be going straight to my brain without passing my ears.
But she doesn't like you either. She thinks you're spoiled, that you haven't been through nearly the kind of stuff that she and I have.
This seemed like a fair criticism. That seems fair, I said. Some weighty and flickering interlude of time seemed to pass. Trembling shadows, static, hiss of unseen projector. When I held out my hand and looked at it, it was dust-speckled and bright, like a decaying piece of film.
Wow, I'm seeing it now too, said Boris, turning to me.
A sort of slowed-down, hand-cranked movement, 14 frames per second. His face was chalk-pale, and his pupils were dark and huge.
Seeing, I said carefully. You know,
he waved his floodlit black-and-white hand in the air.
How it's all flat, like a movie.
But you... It wasn't just me. He saw it too?
Of course, said Boris, looking less and less like a person every moment,
and more like some degraded piece of silver nitrate stock from the 1920s, light shining behind him from some hidden source.
I wish we'd got something color, though, like maybe Mary Poppins.
When he said this, I began to laugh uncontrollably, so hard I nearly fell off the swing, because I knew then for sure he saw the same thing I did. More than that, we were creating it. Whatever the drug was making us see, we were constructing it together. And, with that realization, the virtual reality simulator flipped into color. It happened for both of us at the same time. Pop! We looked at each other and just laughed. Everything was hysterically funny. Even the playground slide was smiling at us. And at some point, deep in the night, when we were swinging on the jungle gym, and showers of sparks were flying out of our mouths, I had the epiphany that laughter was light, and light was laughter, and that this was the secret of the universe. For hours, we watched the clouds rearranging themselves into intelligent patterns, rolled in the dirt, believing it was seaweed, lay on our backs and sang Dear Prudence to the welcoming and appreciative stars. It was a fantastic night, one of the great nights of my life, actually, despite what happened later. 16. Boris stayed over at my house, since I lived closer to the playground, and he was, in his own favorite term for loadedness, Yevgovna, which meant shit-faced or in shit or something of the sort. At any rate, too wrecked to get home on his own in the dark. And this was fortunate, as it meant I wasn't alone in the house at 3:30 the next afternoon when Mr. Silver stopped by. Though we'd barely slept and were a little shaky, everything still felt the tiniest bit magical and full of light. We were drinking orange juice and watching cartoons. Good idea, as it seemed to extend the hilarious Technicolor mood of the evening, and bad idea, had just shared our second joint of the afternoon when the doorbell rang. Popchick, who'd been extremely on edge, he sensed that we were off-key somehow and had been barking at us like we were possessed, went off immediately, almost as if he'd expected something of the sort. In an instant, it all came crashing back.
"Holy shit," I said.
"I'll go," said Boris immediately, tucking Popchick under his arm. Off he bopped, barefoot and shirtless, with an air of complete unconcern. But in what seemed like 1 second, he was back again, looking ashen. He didn't say anything. He didn't have to. I got up, put on my sneakers, and tied them tight, as I'd gotten in the habit of doing before our shoplifting expeditions in the event I had to flee, and went to the door. There was Mr. Silver again, white sports coat, shoe polish hair and all. Only this time, standing beside him, was a large guy with blurred blue tattoos snaked all over his forearms, holding an aluminum baseball bat.
"Well, Theodore," said Mr. Silver.
He seemed genuinely pleased to see me.
"How you doing?"
"Fine," I said, marveling at how unstoned I suddenly felt. "And you?"
"Can't complain. Quite a bruise you got going on there, pal."
Reflexively, I reached up and touched my cheek.
"Better look after that. Your buddy tells me your dad's not home."
"That's right."
"Everything okay with you two? You guys having any problems out here this afternoon?"
"No, not really," I said. The guy wasn't brandishing the bat or being threatening in any way, but still I couldn't help being fairly aware that he had it.
"Because if you ever do," said Mr. Silver, "have problems of any nature, I can take care of them for you like that."
What was he talking about? I looked past him, out to the street, to his car. Even though the windows were tinted, I could see the other men waiting there. Mr. Silver sighed.
"I'm glad to hear that you don't have any problems, Theodore. I only wish that I could say the same."
"Excuse me?"
"Because here's the thing," he continued as if I hadn't spoken.
"I have a problem. A really big one. With your father."
Not knowing what to say, I stared at his cowboy boots. They were black crocodile with a stacked heel, very pointed at the toe and polished to such a high shine that they reminded me of the girly girl cowboy boots that Lucy Lobo, a way-out stylist in my mother's office, had always worn.
"You see, here's the thing," said Mr. Silver. "I'm holding $50,000 of your dad's paper, and that is causing some very big problems for me."
"He's getting the money together," I said awkwardly. "Maybe, I don't know, if you could just give him a little more time." Mr. Silver looked at me. He adjusted his glasses.
"Listen," he said reasonably. "Your dad wants to risk his shirt on how some morons handle a fucking ball. I mean, pardon my language, but it's hard for me to have sympathy for a guy like him. Doesn't honor his obligations, 3 weeks late on the vig, doesn't return my phone calls."
He was ticking off the offenses on his fingers.
"Makes plans to meet me at noon today, and then doesn't show. You know how long I sat and waited for that deadbeat? 1.5 hours. Like I don't got other, better things to do?"
He put his head to the side.
"It's guys like your dad keep guys like me and Yurko here in business. Do you think I like coming to your house, driving all the way out here?"
I had thought this was a rhetorical question. Clearly no one in their right mind would like driving all the way out here where we lived. but since an outrageous amount of time passed, and still he was staring at me like he actually expected an answer, I finally blinked in discomfort and said,
No. No. That's right, Theodore. I most certainly do not. We got better things to do, me and Yurko, believe me, than spend all afternoon chasing after a deadbeat like your dad.
So do me a favor, please, and tell your father we can settle this like gentlemen the second he sits down and works things out with me.
Work things out?
He needs to bring me what he owes.
He was smiling, but the gray tint at the top of his aviators gave his eyes a disturbingly hooded look.
And I want you to tell him to do that for me, Theodore. Because next time I have to come out here, believe me, I'm not going to be so nice.
17. When I came back into the living room, Boris was sitting quietly and staring at cartoons with the sound off, stroking Popper, who, despite his earlier upset, was now fast asleep in his lap.
Ridiculous, he said shortly.
He pronounced the word in such a way that it took me a moment to realize what he'd said.
Right,
I said.
I told you he was a freak.
Boris shook his head and leaned back against the couch.
I don't mean the old Leonard Cohen-looking guy with the wig.
You think that's a wig?
He made a face like, who cares?
Him too. But I mean the big Russian with the metal, what do you call it?
Baseball bat.
That was just for show, he said disdainfully. He was just trying to scare you, the prick.
How do you know he was Russian? He shrugged.
Because I know. No one has tattoos like that in U.S. Russian national, no question. He knew I was Russian, too, minute I opened my mouth.
Some period of time passed before I realized I was sitting there, staring into space. Boris lifted Popchik and put him down on the sofa, so gently he didn't wake.
You want to get out of here for a while?
God, I said, shaking my head suddenly. The impact of the visit had, for whatever reason, just hit me. A delayed reaction.
Buck, I wish my dad had been home, you know? I wish that guy would beat his ass. I really do. He deserves it.
Boris kicked my ankle. His feet were black with dirt, and he also had black polish on his toenails, courtesy of Kotku.
You know what I had to eat yesterday?
He said sociably.
2 Nestle bars and a Pepsi.
All candy bars for Boris were Nestle bars, just as all sodas were Pepsi.
And you know what I had to eat today?
He made a zero with thumb and forefinger.
Null.
Me neither. This stuff makes you not hungry.
Yeah, but I need to eat something. My stomach.
He made a face. Do you want to go get pancakes?
Yes. Something. I don't care. Do you have money?
I'll look around.
Good. I think I have $5, maybe.
While Boris was rummaging for shoes and a shirt, I splashed some water on my face, checked out my pupils and the bruise on my jaw, rebuttoned my shirt when I saw it was done up the wrong way, and then went to let Popchik out, throwing his tennis ball to him for a bit, since he hadn't had a proper walk on the leash, and I knew he felt cooped up. When we came back in, Boris, dressed now, was downstairs. We'd done a quick search of the living room, and were laughing and joking around, pooling our quarters and dimes and trying to figure out where we wanted to go and the quickest way to get there, when all of a sudden we noticed that Zandra had come in the front door and was standing there with a funny look on her face. Both of us stopped talking immediately and went about our change sorting in silence. It wasn't a time when Zandra normally came home, but her schedule was erratic sometimes, and she'd surprised us before. But then, in an uncertain-sounding voice, she said my name. We stopped with the change. Generally, Zandra called me Kiddo or Hey You or anything but Theo. She was, I noticed, still wearing her uniform from work.
Your dad's had a car accident, she said.
It was like she was saying it to Boris instead of me.
Where?
I said.
It happened like 2 hours ago. The hospital called me at work.
Boris and I looked at each other.
Wow,
I said. What happened?
Did he total the car?
His blood alcohol was 0.39.
The figure was meaningless to me, though the fact he'd been drinking wasn't.
Wow,
I said, pocketing my change, and...
When's he coming home, then?
She met my eye, blankly.
Home? From the hospital?
Rapidly, she shook her head, looked around for a chair to sit in, and then sat in it.
You don't understand.
Her face was empty and strange.
He died. He's dead.
18. The next 6 or 7 hours were a daze. Several of Zandra's friends showed up. Her best friend Courtney, Janet from her work, and a couple named Stuart and Lisa, who were nicer and way more normal than the usual people Zandra had over to the house. Boris generously produced what was left of Kotku's weed, which was appreciated by all parties present. And someone, thankfully, maybe it was Courtney, ordered out for pizza. How she got Domino's to deliver all the way out to us, I don't know, since for over a year Boris and I had wheedled and pleaded and tried every cajolement and excuse we could think of. While Janet sat with her arm around Zandra, and Lisa patted her head, and Stuart made coffee in the kitchen, and Courtney rolled a joint on the coffee table that was almost as expert as one of Kotku's, Boris and I hung in the background, stunned. It was hard to believe that my dad could be dead when his cigarettes were still on the kitchen counter and his old white tennis shoes were still by the back door. Apparently, it all came out in the wrong order. I had to piece it together in my mind. My dad had crashed the Lexus on the highway a little before 2 in the afternoon, veering off on the wrong side of the road and plowing headlong into a tractor trailer which had immediately killed him. Not the driver of the truck, fortunately, or the passengers in the car that had rear-ended the truck, although the driver of the car had a broken leg. The blood alcohol news was both surprising and not. I'd suspected my father might be drinking again, though I hadn't seen him doing it. But what seemed to baffle Zandra most was not his extreme drunkenness. He'd been virtually unconscious at the wheel, but the location of the accident. Outside Vegas, heading west into the desert.
He would have told me. He would have told me,
she was saying sorrowfully, in response to some question or other of Courtney's. Only why, I thought bleakly, sitting on the floor with my hands over my eyes, did she think it was in my father's nature to tell the truth about anything? Boris had his arm over my shoulder.
She doesn't know, does she?
I knew he was talking about Mr. Silver. Should I...
Where was he going?
Zandra was asking Courtney and Janet, almost aggressively, as if she suspected them of withholding information.
What was he doing all the way over there?
It was strange to see her still in her work uniform, as she usually changed out of it the second she walked in the door.
He didn't go meet that guy like he was supposed to,
whispered Boris. I know. Possibly he had intended to go to the sit-down with Mr. Silver. But, as my mother and I had so often, so fatally, known him to do, he had probably stopped in a bar somewhere for a quick belt or two, to steady his nerves, as he always said. At that point, who knew what might have been going through his mind? Nothing helpful to point out to Zandra under the circumstances, but he'd certainly been known to skip town on his obligations before. I didn't cry, though cold waves of disbelief and panic kept hitting me. It all seemed highly unreal, and I kept glancing around for him, struck again and again by the absence of his voice among the others, that easy, well-reasoned aspirin commercial voice. 4 out of 5 doctors. That made itself known above all others in a room. Zandra went in and out of being fairly matter-of-fact, wiping her eyes, getting plates for pizza, pouring everybody glasses of the red wine which had appeared from somewhere, and then collapsing in tears again. Popchik alone was happy. It was rare that we had so much company in the house, and he ran from person to person, undiscouraged by repeated rebuffs. At some bleary point, deep in the evening, Zandra weeping in Courtney's arms for the 20th time.
Oh my God, he's gone. I can't believe it.
Boris pulled me aside and said,
Potter, I have to go.
No,
Don't, please. Kotku's going to be freaked out. I'm supposed to be at her mom's now. She hasn't seen me for like 48 hours.